The American History Podcast, Season 2, Episode 7, Andrew Jackson's First Term.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, so welcome back, friends, listeners, newcomers, and old-timers. I'm happy to have you all here today, listening to what is the seventh episode of Season 2 and our 24th overall. Today we're going to talk about Andrew Jackson's first term in office, and this is a long episode. I'm not sure if it'll be our longest, but it's going to clock in pretty close to it. So without further ado, let's get into it. The year is 1828. For the past 4 years, Andrew Jackson has been waiting for this. His chance to redeem himself and win what should, in his mind and in the minds of his supporters, have been his in 1824, the presidency of the United States. Now, we mentioned this last time. The fallout of the election of John Quincy Adams to the presidency was that the one-party system and the so-called era of good feelings just completely falls apart. The Republican Party splits into two factions, the National Republicans, supporters of Clay and Adams, and the Democrats, the supporters of Andrew Jackson. The Adams presidency was not one that is considered successful, as most of his agenda was blocked. One major item does get through Congress, though, and that's the Tariff of Abominations, which wasn't exactly popular. I mean, let's face it, when it's called the Abominations, probably not a good thing. And so this only helps to further what little popularity Adams had with the people. So, how nasty would this civil war within the party get? Well, the Tennessee legislature nominates Jackson for president in October of 1825. And now, if you thought our campaigns are too long, just think about that. We're talking basically 3 years out. The campaign, as you can imagine, was going to get very personal and very nasty. Jackson's opponents attacked him on numerous issues, one of which was attacking him as a slave trader, and they also attacked his record as a general for supposedly ordering soldiers executed at New Orleans during the War of 1812. You even had the 19th century version of fake news in a series of pamphlets known as the Coffin Bills. The first of these accused Jackson of ordering the execution of 6 militiamen during the Creek War. Another one accused Jackson of atrocious and unnatural acts, including the slaughter of 1,000 unarmed natives, sleeping amidst their corpses, and even eating some of them for breakfast. The most notorious of these pamphlets was one which accused Jackson and his wife, Rachel, of bigamy. Now, I left this out of the Jackson bio episode, the previous one, episode 2.6, as I thought it would fit in better right here. So let's take a look at this issue for a few moments. It's pretty interesting here. In 1788, Jackson moved to the small frontier town of Nashville and became a boarder with Rachel Donelson and became acquainted with her daughter, Rachel Donelson Robards. The younger Rachel was a young woman. She was about 24 at the time, and unhappily married to a man named Lewis Robards, someone who was known for his jealousy and his anger. Now, the two separated in 1790, and Jackson and Rachel got married after hearing that the husband had obtained a divorce. However, there was, of course, a problem, as there always is with these sorts of stories. The divorce was not finalized. This meant their marriage was invalid and bigamous. After the divorce was finalized, then they remarried properly in 1794. To make matters worse, historian Robert Remini notes, there is evidence that Rachel was living with Jackson, referring to herself as Mrs. Jackson before the divorce petition had even been filed. Now, this is quite common in frontier communities in the late 18th, early 19th century, but it would come back to haunt the two of them over 3 decades later. The stress of the campaign was apparently too much for Mrs. Jackson, and she ended up dying of a heart attack on December 22nd, just 3 weeks after her husband was elected president. Buried at the Hermitage on Christmas Eve, Jackson is said to have said, quote, "May God forgive her murderers," end quote, for he never would. But the Democrats gave as good as they got. The accused President Adams, during his stint as the ambassador to Russia, essentially as acting as a procurer of young women for the Tsar. I'll let your imagination fill in the blanks, is what they were accusing him of. They also accused Adams of essentially turning the White House into a casino, saying that he supposedly used public money to purchase gambling devices. Now, what he had actually purchased was a pool table and a chess set. So this is why when people decry the nastiness of modern elections, and inevitably we hear every single time, this is the worst election ever. And if you're one of my students, you know that I despise that term, and it usually will send me into about a five-minute meltdown and rant, because I just go nuts. Seriously, no one is dying in this election. No one's – whatever election you're talking about – in the last, let's say, 20, 30 years, no one has had a heart attack from it. You know, or you could mention the aftermath of the 1800 election. Aaron Burr shoots Alexander Hamilton. Again, nobody's shooting at anybody. Nowhere near as dirty as some of the earlier elections. But anyways, in the end, Jackson defeats Adams 178 electoral votes to 83. And in doing so, he becomes the first president from the West, and this is seen as the ultimate achievement of the great common man. Now, of course, the ironic thing is he owned one of the largest plantations in the West, and he had numerous slaves. Andrew Jackson is, if anything, not common, okay? But it is a thing in American politics for politicians to try and make themselves out to be common people. You see this all the time. It started during the Jackson era. Even today, people like George W. Bush with his Crawford Ranch and going to Clear Brush. Barack Obama filling out his March Madness brackets. Bill Clinton eating hamburgers at a fast food joint. You know, heck, even Donald Trump had the red ball cap trying to, you know, look like he's one of the people. Okay. Of course, none of these people is common. Obama was Harvard and Columbia. Obviously, Donald Trump is not common. George W. Bush was not common. Bill Clinton was, you know, a Rhodes Scholar. He's not common. They may have been at one point, but definitely not by the time they're running for president. And so where does his support come from? Geographically, it comes from the West, the South, and from laborers on the East Coast. Now, having said that, the Democrats relied also on machine politicians in places like New York and Pennsylvania to help turn out the votes, which they did. Adams, as one would expect, won amongst the New England states and the wealthy voters located in the Northeast. And so this election comes to be known as the Revolution of 1828. It sees an increase in participation from 9% to – or from 3%, I should say, in 1824 to 9%. In 1828. Now, this uptick in voting was decisive as the balance of power began to shift from the East to the West. And this is the first time since 1800 that a sitting president had lost his re-election campaign. The first time that it happened, to John Adams, and now it was John Quincy Adams who it was happening to. It was also the first time a president held from a state not named Virginia or Massachusetts. And finally, America, a country once ruled by educated wealthy elites, Federalist merchants, and Jeffersonian planters, was slowly changing. Okay. Now, President Jackson was sworn into office on March 4th, 1829. A personification of the New West, he sees the federal government as a haven for wealth that was detached from the common people. And so, like Jefferson, he wanted to reduce the role of government in favor of states' rights. But only so long as those states' rights didn't conflict with his plans. Now remember, he hated Henry Clay and his American system. So Andrew Jackson's siding with states' rights was mainly about his personal feud with Henry Clay, not about any ideological loyalty to the idea of local government. As a matter of fact, on that issue, Jackson was first and foremost a unionist and a nationalist, which the South would come to understand soon enough. He believed the federal government was supreme over the states. In this vein, he was a believer in a strong presidency, and this should be no surprise. He was a military man. He saw things in terms of a chain of command. He was used to being on top of that chain, and he would continue to expect people to, if you will, obey orders. Now, while he did believe in the Union and central government, he often defied the will of Congress and the Supreme Court. Now, this act of his personality, you very much see him acting as the king that he was accused of being by his Republican opponents. One of his favorite methods of getting his way was to use the presidential veto, and he used it 12 times, while his predecessors combined used it 10 times. So King Andrew was a charge that he very much, in my opinion, lived up to. Now, one of the early controversies in the Jackson administration is what is known as the Petticoat Affair. Secretary of War John Henry Eaton's wife, Peggy, was known for her beauty and her witty personality. She was also controversial as she married Senator Eaton just a few months after her husband had died. Peggy was then snubbed by the wives of other cabinet members, and there were salacious rumors of her as a sexually promiscuous woman, or perhaps as even having been a prostitute at one point. All of these things did the rounds. There were other rumors that she and Mr. Eaton had been lovers while her husband was still alive. So needless to say, all the wives, led by Mrs. Calhoun, refused to socialize with the Eatons. Jackson did not believe the rumors, and he ended up stating that Peggy was as chaste as a virgin. Now, the way that his wife had been treated surely led Jackson to dig in his heels on this issue. In any case, eventually the president asked for and received the resignations of all of the cabinet members. This had been suggested by Martin Van Buren, who had taken Jackson's side in the controversy. And this whole incident leads to the development of something that was referred to as the kitchen cabinet. So let's take a look at that. So at times, Jackson met with an unofficial group of about 13 temporary advisors, some of whom were newspaper people, keeping the president in touch with public opinion. The Jackson critics branded this group the kitchen cabinet. The opponents of this unofficial cabinet were angered by the fact that they, unlike the official cabinet, were not answerable to Congress. In the minds of Jackson's opponents, this was a threat to the checks and balances of the Constitution. However, the reality is the group never met officially, and most historians feel its influence is greatly exaggerated. Further, the reality is that this is not unconstitutional. The president is allowed to seek counsel and advice from unofficial advisors. And most likely, Jackson is not the first president to have done so. Okay. But as Jackson enters office, he is concerned with corruption in the federal bureaucracy, as we kind of mentioned earlier. To try and stamp down on this, what would be termed the spoil system was brought to the federal government. This practice involved rewarding political supporters with public offices, regardless of their merit. It was a system devised by Secretary of State Martin Van Buren, the guy who engineered the political machine in New York, and was referred to as the Albany Regency. This is why you often see someone appointed as, let's say, Secretary of State, Secretary of Commerce, etc., more as a reward for their loyalty during the campaign as opposed to their actual expertise. And we have some examples from modern times. For example, what actual diplomatic experience did Colin Powell have to be named Secretary of State? Sure, in his capacity as a general, there would have been some times when diplomacy was a part of his job. However, was he the best choice for chief diplomat of the United States? How about Hillary Clinton? Rex Tillerson? None of these were chosen necessarily based on their actual qualifications for the job. Furthermore, Jackson believed in rotation in office, or what others have termed turnabout as fair play. His stated goal was to let as many citizens as possible hold office for at least a short time. He was also, as it happens, attempting to remove Adams' Clay officials and replace them with his own loyalists. Now, the odd thing is, he only ends up removing about 20% of incumbents from office. And while that's a fairly significant sweep to do it all at once, if you consider that it happened fairly quickly, at least, the reality is it wasn't a full or complete makeover. It also sets a precedent for the future. The consequences of this system are threefold. Number one, a national political machine is built up around Jackson. Number two, competence and merit are subordinated to political concerns, and many able and competent citizens are left out. And number three, rather than eliminate political corruption, it actually encourages it. So that brings us to the tariff of abominations. So let's backtrack a little bit, but hopefully it'll make sense in the end. In the Adams administration, the Congress increased the tariff from 23% on dutiable goods to 37%. This is largely a protective tariff designed to keep foreign goods either out of the U.S. market or to make them so expensive that consumers would just shun them and instead buy those made at home. In 1828, New England pushed for passage of a new tariff that would raise the rate to an unprecedented 45%. Daniel Webster argued for the tariff this time, reversing his previous position on the issue. John C. Calhoun argued against it on the basis that such a tariff would hurt the South. So the table was set for a standoff of epic proportions, one that threatened to tear the Union apart. The tariff ended up passing, and Southerners who were furious at the result dubbed it the Tariff of Abominations. They feared the power of the federal government had become too strong, and they decried the fact that they would now suffer both as consumers and exporters. They would have to pay higher prices on the goods they purchased and on the items that they exported to England. Those would likely have a reciprocal tariff placed upon them, thus meaning they'd be likely to sell fewer of those items. So all of this led to Calhoun's South Carolina Exposition. This was written secretly when Calhoun was the vice president under John Adams. Now, in it, he denounces the tariff as unjust and unconstitutional. He said states should use the Jeffersonian idea of nullification to nullify the tariff. If you're wondering what he's referring to, this is Jefferson and Madison's Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798. Calhoun hoped that this would save the Union by forcing the general government to lower the offensive tariff. If not, he felt the Union could be broken apart. Now, unfortunately for Calhoun, only South Carolina supports this idea. Now, where does Jackson stand on the issue? While he was sympathetic to the South, he was also a believer in a strong central government, and he would never agree to the idea that a state had the right to nullify a federal law. They might get the idea to nullify a law he liked, and that would never do. To make matters worse, Jackson decided to face down Calhoun on the issue, and this would help to build a bitter rivalry between these two men. At the annual Jefferson Day dinner, Robert Hayne, an ally of Calhoun and a proponent of the doctrine of states' rights, began a toast, quote, "the union of the states and the sovereignty of the states," end quote. Jackson, in response, rose and added, quote, "our federal union, it must be preserved," end quote. Clearly, this was a challenge to the states' rights group and Calhoun in particular. Not one to take such a challenge lying down, Calhoun responds, "the union, next to our liberty, the most dear." Needless to say, the war between the two had just begun. In May of that year, Jackson learned that Calhoun had asked President Monroe to censure the then General Jackson for the invasion of Spanish Florida. Now, this was at a time when Calhoun was Secretary of War. To make matters even worse, there were inaccurate reports in the press of the feud between the two men. Calhoun, in response, had letters published in the United States Telegraph. These were angry letters between the two men that they had exchanged over a period of several months, and it led to that newspaper becoming a supporter of Calhoun and a critic of Jackson. So, back to the tariff. Senator Robert Hayne debated the issue of the tariff in the Senate, taking the side against the increase in duties. Now, Hayne, just for your information, was a South Carolinian, a Calhoun protege, and thus he was pro-states' rights. He accused New England of disloyalty during the War of 1812, and he condemned their selfishness with regards to the tariff. He proclaimed Calhoun's doctrine of nullification was the only means of protecting Southern rights. Now, speaking on behalf of the tariff and the union was Daniel Webster. He insisted that people, not the states, frame the Constitution, and he assailed the doctrine of nullification. Now, there are many problems with Webster's argument, historically speaking. First, he's wrong about the people framing the Constitution. The states ratified the Constitution, and that's why each of the original 13 states held ratifying conventions within their states. As for nullification, I would have to do a bonus episode on it, which I might do one day. Suffice it to say for now that Webster's rejecting Jefferson and Madison's compact theory of government. The compact theory states that the United States was created by the states when they essentially created a compact, the Constitution. As such, the states have the final say on what is and is not constitutional. The general government is, in essence, their agent. They created it, and thus they are the final judge. Webster famously said, "Liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Now, interestingly, Daniel Webster sung a far different tune in the earlier decades of the 19th century, back when New England wasn't as powerful. In the first and second decade of the century, he was definitely, well, I'll let you hear him for yourself. Here's some of Webster in 1812. Quote, "We are, sir, from principle attached to the substance and not to the form," end quote. He means by substance the original union. And the substance of that, the liberty of that, the idea that this is a compact between the states. If the time arrives when the union is held together by nothing but the authority of law, of power, and of force, then the country is no longer prosperous. And while he believes in the union, he believes that separation could happen. Okay. When he says, when one portion attempts to take control and sacrifice the rights and prosperity of another section, this is dangerous and the states have the right to leave. Now, this is a northerner. He sounds almost like a southerner in the lead up to the Civil War. If you want to read more about the two different Daniel Websters, you can check out a book by Albert Taylor Bledsoe titled "Is Davis a Traitor?" It's an old book. It was published in 1907. But you can get it for free on Google Books. Don't check your local library. I assure you, they won't have it. Now, the results of the debate are that it illustrates the rising tide of sectionalism already here, three decades out from the war between the states. Some would credit Webster with helping to win the Civil War because he helped arouse a new generation of patriotic Northerners who wanted to fight for the ideals of the Union. Now, personally, I think that's going a bit too far myself, but there you have it. In 1832, Calhoun resigns the vice presidency. The tariff was the major wedge between Calhoun and Jackson. Now, up until this point, Calhoun was a strong nationalist. He saw himself as next in line for the presidency after Jackson served his term. However, his falling out with Jackson ended up ruining any chance that he had of winning the nomination. And so in the aftermath, Calhoun becomes more and more of a states' rights advocate. Okay, so now it's 1832. Calhoun is out. South Carolina is still fuming about the 1828 tariff, the tariff of abominations. They, South Carolina, see the tariff as punitive in the short term and in the long term as well as setting a precedent for federal interference with states' rights. In an attempt to lower the tariff as a way to make up with the South, Jackson proposes that they lower the tariff from 45 to 35%, or to about the level it was in 1824. Yet the law was still, without a doubt, a protective tariff, not simply one designed to raise revenue. It fell short of what the South wanted, so you can imagine this is going to please no one. And so, in the end, South Carolina decides they're going to nullify it. They also called on the state government to take all necessary measures to prepare the militia for conflict. Further, they threatened to actually secede from the Union if Jackson attempted to collect the tariff by force. Well, I'm sure you can imagine, how is Jackson going to respond to all of this? Yep, you're right. Jackson condemned nullification. He is said to have become violently angry in private and threatened to hang the nullifiers, including Calhoun. He dispatched modest naval and military reinforcements to South Carolina while, at the same time, quietly preparing a sizable army. Governor Robert Hayne, formerly Senator Hayne, rigorously advocated nullification, and the standoff threatened to cause a civil war. So into this situation steps Henry Clay, the great compromiser. He proposed a compromise tariff in 33. He said the 1832 tariff would be reduced by 10 points over a period of 8 years. Rates would eventually hit the levels of 1816, or about 20%. Of course, many in New England and the mid-Atlantic states, where the Industrial Revolution was beginning to take hold, they opposed this. Calhoun in the South, they favored it. So in the end, the compromise tariff of 1833 squeezes through Congress. In response, South Carolina withdraws its nullification of the tariff. However, this isn't quite over yet. Congress passes in 1833 the Force Bill, an attempt to save face. It said that in the future, the president could use military force to collect federal tariffs if the need arose. This was dubbed the Bloody Bill by South Carolinians, and the state promptly nullified it. The after effects of all this would be far-reaching. First, this is a stepping stone to the Civil War. South Carolina will gradually abandon the ideas of nullification in favor of secession. Just a side note, this is exactly as Jefferson predicted. He said that without nullification, states' only recourse to federal tyranny would be to secede. The second effect was that the tariff crisis was the most compelling reason for the permanent split of Jackson and Calhoun. Third, Henry Clay was later criticized by Northerners as being a Southern appeaser, and this is going to doom his chances of ever being elected president. However, it should be noted that, in the end, Clay saved the Union from a civil war that the North was unprepared for. If the South fought valiantly in the 60s, only to fail, one could imagine that, in the 1830s, prior to the North becoming industrialized, the South very well might have won. Okay, well, that's all for today. 27, 28 minutes, long episode, but we covered most, if not all, of the major events of Jackson's first term. As always, you can go to the website to see the sources that I'm using to create season two. You can also sign up for email updates, and if you want, you can follow me on Twitter at AmericanHisCast. Please, if you're enjoying these episodes, go over to iTunes, give us a good review, or leave us just a 5-star rating. If you've got a compliment or a question about the podcast, or if there's an issue, please email me, and I'll get back to you on that as soon as I can. All right, until next time, good day.